Thanks, Dmitry, for the invitation. So it's a pleasure to be here in this nice institute. So as Dmitry is saying, we have a little bit of a trouble with assigning credit for this. So the Ostrowski equation is, what they say, Ostrowski equation is a family of one-parameter family of equations that contains the short post as a particular case for p equal to 3. So you'll see now. So here it is. I attributed several names because, you know, this equation was derived in several different contexts, and at least it was put forward. At least the coefficient there is 1, you know, at least the integrable cases, you have to put 1 over 6, I believe. But anyway, so I'll just look at this because I'm not going to be interested in, well, I'm not going to use any integrability, so for me, this is good enough. So you see the equation looks like the Klein-Gordon equation. If you change the variables, it looks like a Klein-Gordon, except the nonlinearity, of course, is this horrible-looking second-order derivative applied to a power. And so here, of course, we look at the initial value problem, and we may have trouble if p is not necessarily integer, but I'll just sort of ignore these issues. So let me just talk about a little bit about history here. Here is some names, and I'm sure my list is not complete, so I apologize for that. So the case p equal to 2 has appeared in the literature, and so you can see some credit that I attribute here. As I said, I'm sure my list is not complete. But in any case, it's a good model mathematically that also makes sense physically, at least from this works. So again, I'm going to look at the Cauchy problem. So half of my talk, you can, for the well-posedness, at least for the local well-posedness part, you can just look at periodic case as well. It's not going to make much difference. For the global well-posedness stuff, of course, it will make a difference. But so in any case, I'm just going to state the things for the line. Okay, so the case p equal to 3 is the short pulse, so which is, I guess, in the title of the workshop. So, of course, there is a lot of things known about this. Again, I have maybe the wrong coefficient, but if you put the right coefficient in front of the nonlinearity, this becomes completely integrable, and it's, in fact, there is a clever transformation which converts this into the sine Gordon, which is known to be completely integrable as well. And so, of course, this comes with infinite hierarchy of conserved quantities. And so this actually has been exploited by another member of the audience, so Stakovich, in 05. So they, established this or, you know, observed this in this 05 paper. Okay, so then they, of course, from the complete integrability, you can derive all kind of explicit solutions. And so that was done in a subsequent paper in 06. And then wave breaking, which is another, I guess, relevant phenomena, which is for this workshop at least, is it was observed that wave breaking in the sense of the Kamatsa-Holm and all the other equations that are under interest. So this actually happens, and this is both in periodic and whole line context. So this is a paper that one of the relevant papers in 09. So Liu, Pelinowski, and Sekovich. So this is the short pulse stuff, at least a little bit of the theory. So here is a local well-posedness result, which was actually done in 04 by Tobias Schaeffer and Jin Wayne. So the general, what I call general, is Ostrowski, right, which is my formulation, with the power p is well-posed in H2, and I think this result may require p to be integer, which I think it's a valid requirement because of issues with smoothness of the nonlinearity. So two derivatives on the something like u to the p requires some smoothness. So just think of p being an integer, although this may be too much, but anyway. So you may ask, well, what is the solution here? And so here is one way, of course. You just say that u is a weak solution if you require a little bit of smoothness to place it in L infinity. And then, of course, you move all the derivatives onto the test function. That's one way to think about wall poseness. Of course, I actually have a different definition. So we managed with Yanan and Panos Kivrikidis to lower this Q to 3 halves. And of course, what we did, you know, Q, of course, is an integer, 3 halves is not. And, you know, of course, when you do that stuff, you need some kind of harmonic analysis. So maybe I'll just display first what I mean by wall poseness. So this is a little tough to read, but essentially what it says is that you require, okay, so you say something's locally well posed in HS0 if you can construct solution. So let's say you pick a very smooth data, right? So this is very smooth, but you can construct the time depending only on this S0, right? So only initial data, so that the classical solution is what it needs to be, right? So the point is that you construct classical solutions, but the time of existence depends only on this zero. And then for uniqueness, you have some kind of Lipschitz. But so now the Lipschitzness is in a very special sense, right? S2 is low regularity Sobolev space, and so the constant depends on this S0. So the Lipschitzness is very weak, right? So you require Lipschitzness in a lower regularity space. So this, of course, implies at least some kind of uniqueness, but you know, it's not much, right? In terms of you know, Lipschitzness of the data to solution map, it's not there. That's probably a theorem. I'm going to ask this question, right? In fact, one of the questions I'm going to ask as an open question is, you know, what is the optimal S2 given S0? So in our case, well, you see, basically you have to go one derivative down, but that's probably not optimal. Okay, so here is our result. I put the integer there, so S bigger than 3 halves, and it's so the Ostrovsky's well posed in HS. So, you know, in particular, there is a time which depends on this HS norm, so that the problem has unique solution. So here I put up to and including infinity in the hope that, you know, sometimes the solution is global, although we know there is a wave breaking, so most of the time this will be just a local solution, and the solution will break up in finite time. But who knows, right? Sometimes it's actually global. And you will see that for small data, that's the case, at least for some indices of P. Okay, so here are some comments. This is a quaternary wave equation. You know, most likely the map, the data to solution map is not even maybe uniformly continuous, but it's probably not even Lipschitz. I mean, it's probably not Lipschitz. So you cannot hope to produce solution by a fixed point argument. That would be too much. So that means that you cannot hope to produce solution by a fixed point iteration procedure. And this was already observed by Jean Wynn and Scheffer. Or not observed, but you know, their way of producing, of course, was through energy estimate. That would be our result. Oops. Okay, so here is the result that I mentioned. So in our approach, we, of course, prove Lipschitzness from H a half plus to H a half plus, but of course the constant depends on the 3 half norm of the two solutions, right? So if you have two solutions coming out of F and G, so then the H a half plus norm at later time, before the blow-up, right, is controlled by this. So I don't know whether that's optimal or not, probably not, but we have one derivative loss in the Lipschitzness of the map. Okay. So I think for the Alex can probably for the Kamasa home you have Lipschitzness as long as you drop a little bit below, right? So that's one derivative. So that's probably not optimal. But of course the equation may be worse. So I don't know. Okay. So let's talk about global solutions. At least in the short pulse case, p equal to 3. So Pelinowski and Sakovich, they proved the global solutions, you know, if you have small data, then the local result persists to global. But so for this, they use conservation. Yeah, probably should display the next one. So they display they use conservation laws because, you know, in this particular case, p equal to 3, you actually have this nice relation to the signed Gordon, and then of course you have all these conservation laws coming from the integrability. So that result though is not showing that the data actually, that the solution actually goes to zero in some way, right? I mean, you know, it's just the global well-poseness based on conservation laws, but it does not show scattering, right? So small solutions do not necessarily go to zero, at least in this proof. And so here is my question, right? Does scattering really happen, right? So small solution, do small solutions go to zero? Okay, and so in our paper, which is actually probably a year old already, so we showed this with this restriction p bigger than 4. And actually, I wanted to talk a little bit. I mean, I wanted to sort of concentrate on this particular aspect of it, right? So why this p bigger than 4? I mean, what happens for p equal to 2 and 3? And I'll talk about this a little bit. So first, to say why this p bigger than 4 appears in the argument. Okay, so the result is this, right? So here you expect to lose derivatives. This h5 could be improved to half derivative, you know, maybe h4. I don't know. I mean, you know, we didn't really care about this too much. And so then you have this this space is like three derivatives in L1. So you require smallness for f in very smooth, in the space of functions, which is very smooth and very decaying. So you have global solution. You have persistence of smallness. And then actually you have, so here is the scattering is in this sense, right? So those of you who recognize Trickert's spaces, this is one of them, right? We'll actually discuss those. Okay, these are actually not quite Trickert because you have fixed number of derivatives. But anyway, so this is some kind of a mixed norm. So at least in that sense, the solution scatters, right? The W 3/2 R norm, so this is 3/2 derivative in LR, decays, you know, it's placed in LQ where Q is in this range. So heuristically, and actually we did numerics, the LR norm of the solution decays like free solution, and that should be in this form. Okay, so that's the global result. So now a few words about the proof. Well, okay, so a few remarks first. Of course, this is like the Klein-Gordon in 1D, so if you at least in principle, right, again, I said I have a problem with P not being integer because of smoothness issues, but if you ignore this thing, you know, in some way, you can, in principle, go down to the Strauss exponent, which is not a surprise because 1D Klein-Gordon, of course, you can do the same kind of stuff up to down to this index 3 plus square root of 17 over 2, which is about 3.56, but you can still, you still cannot cover the case of 3, which is, I guess, the short pulse. So so to just make this, you know, obvious, is I mean, to state the obvious, we cannot do the case p equal to 3. So you cannot show small data for the short pulse, produce the solutions that are global, maybe, by Perinovsky and Sekovich, but they do not necessarily go to 0, or at least we don't know yet. Okay, so this is probably the best you can do by just improving the method that I displayed. Okay, so here's another remark. If you do this, for example, the Strauss exponent result, you have to, I mean, somehow the smoothness requirement, you know, increases, which we're not too much concerned about. You know, the smoothness is going to increase when you go down in P. Okay, so here's some ingredients in the proof, and most of them actually are already in Wayne. Here we just make them precise for the case 3/2. We had to make some improvements to go down to 3/2. So here is a very general energy estimate in this context. So here is an equation that looks like ours. So you pick up the term that contains, you know, the second derivative. I just put it in this divergence form. It's easier to deal with. And then there is a term G. In fact, if you just do energy estimates for the original equation, you don't need that. You don't need this term G. But then when you do estimates for the difference, right, for the Lipschitzness, actually there's error terms which appear as G, right, lower order terms, right? So here are terms where, you know, you don't see second derivatives on any single term, right? For example, you don't have UXX. So this is like the two derivatives will fall on two different terms. So in any case, I mean, you have an estimate which is basically like this. And so so this estimate is used to, well, this is purely done with Lidl's Paley theory. I'm not going to discuss too much about this. But so how do you actually prove the theorem? And this is, again, in Scheffer and Wayne, so or some kind of similar scheme. So what you do, you start with U0, which is initial data, you know, time independent. And then you run this iteration procedure. So basically, you solve a linear equation, okay, for un, based on the previous iterate un minus 1. And so you put it in this form. And so, of course, if un and un minus 1 are equal, you have a solution of the Ostrovsky of order p, right? But, you know, otherwise you just solve a linear equation. And of course, you use the energy estimate to close the argument. So, of course, you need several things going on that you need to check, and it's basically this. So you have to, I mean, you know, if you apply the energy estimate that I just, that I showed you, you have to apply the energy estimate for F, which is here, and so you have to control F in HS if you go back, and then the derivative of F in L infinity, and so that kind of requires S to be 3 halves. I mean, basically, you have to control U prime in L infinity. So that's, it's essentially the burger stuff that we talked about. So it's not much going on. So when you want to do the Lipschitz stuff, G appears, and then you need control of G as well, right? So for the existence, so the existence part does not require G, but if you want to show the Lipschitzness, G actually appears. Okay, so I'm not going to talk much about this. It's sort of straightforward. Follows the Schaeffer and Wien scheme, and then uses this a little bit better energy estimate to go down to 3 halves. Okay, so how do we prove the global result? And so this is actually also, I would say, standard. So here it is, right? So if you apply the energy estimate to, suppose now you have small data, right? So if you apply the energy estimate that I displayed a few slides ago to the HS norm, you end up with, I mean, you know, you just crank up all the estimates, do Hyoder, whatever, so you end up with this. So what you see here is a Hyoder type of, you know, differential inequality, where the right-hand side is again the HS norm plus, you know, times this stuff. And so of course Gronow. So when you apply Gronow, you get this. So what you see here is a typical persistent estimate, as long as you can prove that this thing stays under control, right? So what you have here, p is the power of the nonlinearity. And this is like one derivative in L infinity, right? This quantity over here. Okay, so basically you have the basic persistence estimate, let's say bounded by 3. This is bounded by 1, right? So our goal now is to combine this energy estimate that we got, this number 3, with some kind of control of this norm. So clearly we need to control this norm, keep it under some small number in order to get our solution to be global. Okay, so of course, to do that, you need some kind of decay estimate or Sickert estimate. So, and this is actually, okay, so this is now what I'm looking at this term now. This is pretty much the linear part, right? So I'm just looking at the linear equation with right-hand side F. You write the solution in Fourier transform, it looks like this. And then, you know, it's just very easy to see this. I mean, I'll actually say a few words about this. So this, of course, conserves L2 norm, and it has decay estimates just as in the case of Klein-Gordon. So it's the same. So the number of derivatives that you see here is exactly the Klein-Gordon, which is not a big surprise. This is like Klein-Gordon here. In fact, you can get Strickert. So this I'm not using, but, of course, you know, this follows directly from this, so I couldn't resist. So decay and L2 conservation give you Strickert. So this is not used here, but you know, a few years down the road, we're going to be doing stability, and this kind of stuff will appear. So you know, I'll just record it. Okay. So you always, for stability, you always need an ingredient which contains some kind of Strickert estimate. Of course, for stability of zero solution, we don't need Strickert, but for stability of non-trivial solutions, we do need. So global existence in this case, it's mean stability of the zero solution, right? So this is what we do. Okay, so here are a few explanations. Strickert's just a direct consequence of energy and decay. Energy is just trivial by Poincaré. Decay estimates are scale invariant, so it suffices to look at this formula. So basically, so without this phi would be the formula for the solution for the linear Ostrovsky. And now we just put this smooth cutoff around 1. Okay, so this is just the Fourier transform, inverse Fourier transform. Here's the symbol of the linear part. So we need to prove this, right? And of course, all you do is you set up this face function new, right? So you when you organize the face function, it looks like this. All you have to check is that the second derivative stays away from zero, and you're done, right? So the second derivative is 2 over c cubed of this expression. And of course, this phi keeps it away from zero, so that's it, right? So that means that you have this decay going from L1 to infinity of the order of 1 over square root of t. So this is pretty classic. I mean, for those of you who are not familiar, this may look like a big deal, but it's actually pretty it's straightforward. Okay, all these derivatives disappeared because of this scale invariance, so I'm just left with everything at scale 0. Okay, so this is just a one-page summary of the previous page. Okay, so now we're going to the equation. I have all these tools, decay estimates. How do I control this, right? Remember, this was what I needed to control. So I write the equation in Duhamel's form. This is the nonlinearity, of course. And T of T is the generator of the linear Ostrovsky. Okay. Okay, so here is what I want to prove, right? I would like to prove that the integral term is controlled by this quantity that I want it to be small times back in terms of u of xt. So what is xt here? Xt is my space that I defined here. So first of all, 3/2 this belongs to L infinity h 3/2, and then this is really the decay space that I wanted to control, right? This is L2 in time, 3/2 derivatives in L infinity. This 3/2 is just convenient here. So the point was to actually control this kind of quantity, and this is well controlled by these two norms, right? So use interpolation, so these two norms will control this norm. So if you can prove some kind of estimate like this, you have a posteriori control of this quantity here, and hence you have proved global solutions for small data. So all we need to prove really is this estimate over here. Okay, so here is how it goes. Close to zero, you do the usual stuff, so you don't need to worry about it being close to zero. When you apply the decay estimates, you get this. Okay, so now clearly you have a term here. So all these derivatives come from the decay estimate. So clearly here you have a term for which you have to apply the commutator estimates of Kato and Ponce. I guess they've been around forever, so people know. So what happens essentially, you have to apply two derivatives plus this stuff to one term. So here it is. And then you place this in L2, and then the rest, p minus one copies of u, right? You place them in the rest. Okay. So this is your estimate now, which you're gonna plug in here. So the next step here, of course, this is a huge number of derivatives, right? But remember, I have this energy estimate which controls all the higher Sobolev norms in terms of the initial data, right? So the energy estimate was designed in a way so that any HS here would be controlled by initial data in HS, and this constant is independent of how many derivatives you put here. Well, it's dependent, but that doesn't really bother you that much. So the fact that you have too many derivatives here is just a fact of life, right? So this is where you get the phi from, right? So when you organize things here, you have to take alpha equal to 3/2, et cetera. So you get pretty much, you get phi. Okay, so we plug everything in the equation, and we use hard-riddle Sobolev. So this is basically an inequality that controls convolution of terms. And so this is the term that we discussed on the previous slide. And so this is what you get here. So the point now is that this norm here is also controlled by my X norm. Okay, so this is now the relation. So what is beta? Beta is related to Q and R in this way. So Q and R, remember, 1 over Q and 1 over R less than a half. And so what you want to observe now is that 1 over this index and 1 over this index is bounded by a half, provided p bigger than 4. So here's the point where you use p bigger than 4. So you want p to be large enough in order for this index and this index to satisfy this. So remember, my space x has the property that 1 over q plus 1 over r less than a half. So I need to have that in order to control this norm effectively. Okay, so if you put all these two together, like I said, you control this U in such a way, in a space where 1 over Q plus 1 over R less than a half, and you basically close the argument. Okay, so, and again, P bigger than 4 here, P bigger than 4 here would require, it's required in the previous one, so let me just say, right here. Yeah, let me just discuss this in more detail. So here, 1 over beta, so let's see, 1 over p minus 1, then we have 1 over beta plus 1 over this. So this is exactly the right-hand side of this, and so that's 1 plus 1 over q. Okay, and then p bigger than, well, this index here, so here q, right, so here q can go all the way, so this p minus 1 will become 1/3, and so this q actually, if I want this q to go all the way to 2, right, this was the idea. So this would be 3/2. So I have 1/3 times 3/2, and that's less than a half. So here really you're forced to take p bigger than 4 in this approach. You just have no other way. Okay. So I guess this point was important here. All right. So if you go through this stuff, you end up with the right thing. Okay. Like I said, this could be improved. So let's see, how do you improve to the Strauss index? Well, you have to be more careful in the choice of, let me go back a little bit, of this space, right? So here, instead of taking L2, W3/2, and this, so this space needs to be refined. So you cannot go all the way to L2, you have to go actually to the Strauss index L2 here, and put the corresponding LR, right? So that 1 over Q plus 1 over R is equal to 1/2. So in any case, so if you go through this, it's the same argument for the Klein-Gordon, right? For the scattering for the Klein-Gordon. So you go the same way. So you have to go basically up to the Strauss index, and you have to choose the Strauss index. So the Strauss index comes from a quadratic equation that needs to be solved. So essentially you want, I just forgot now, I think what you want is so this number p of the nonlinearity times q prime, I forgot. So, but it comes from a quadratic equation related to the power. Yeah. Yeah. Right. So you don't. The answer is you don't. You can improve it a little bit, but okay. So let me just go back. Yeah, this is actually an important point. So here, p minus 1 is, so if p is 3, you want to push this to 2. So let's put it this way, right? So if p is 3, you want to control L2, W1 infinity. So if you really wanted to do it for p equal to 3, you have to do q equal to 2. But then, yeah, this is probably the point that I needed to address. But then you have trouble here, right? P equal to 3 will give you 1/2. This would give you 3/2, and end up with 3/4, which is not less than a half. So you go outside of the decay range. And so what I'm saying here, for p bigger than 4, it works, and you can sort of push it down to the Strauss index, 3 plus square root of 17 over 2. But you cannot go below, I don't think with this argument you can go below that. And this is actually well known for Klein-Gordon, which is pretty much the same equation, right, as far as this stuff is concerned, as far as scattering is concerned. Okay, so yeah, so that's the, so here there is a little bit of a if alpha is 3/2, what do you get here? If R here could be potentially infinity. Remember, we need to control L2 W, center number derivative is infinity. So if R is infinity, and alpha, I need alpha to be 3/2, that this turns out to be 5, right? That's why I need 5 derivatives in F. Okay. So the bottom line is that you cannot do P equal to 3. You can do a little bit below 4, but not down to 3. Okay. So here's a few open questions that I wanted to sort of put forward, because people were interested in that in their talk. So here it is, right? We know this is well posed. There's a solution map which is well defined for s bigger than 3/2. But now, what is the optimal index here, right? So given S, right, what is the optimal alpha so that the map is too well posed? And from the announcement of Alex's student talk, right, you can, for Kamasa Home, you can go, as long as alpha is less than S, you're fine, right? But, okay, well, so clearly this constant may also depend on alpha in some way, right? Especially if you have this kind of behavior, right, for alpha less than S. But, so that's an open question, right, whether one can do this kind of stuff. So here, it's another thing I wanted to draw your attention to. So this time is supposed to depend only on the HS norms, right, in the base space in which you're looking. I don't think the map is Lipschitz, right? Maybe it's not even uniformly continuous. I wouldn't think so. But anyway, so another big question which I'm going to talk about a little bit towards the end is what happens for 2 and 3, right? Especially, well, p equal to 3 seems sort of close. P equal to 2 seems completely out of question, right? Although I will show you that actually the case p equal to 2 reduces the case p equal to 3 in a second. So really the question is about short poles, right? So here's the question. If you have small data in the short poles for p equal to 3, is it true that the solution is global and decaying, right? And actually, the corresponding question for Klein-Gordon is actually, the answer is false, right? So this is actually a result of Glassy in 1973, which says that, I believe I'm right about this, I just checked it yesterday. So we're talking about Klein-Gordon in 1D, this thing, which is pretty similar, right? Ignoring all the derivatives, this is the equation, and Glassy shows that that this thing does not, so in other words, small data does not necessarily produce, well, produces global solutions, but not necessarily, decaying ones, I believe. And also there is also related result. Maybe you have to go like this. Maybe you have to go with the Hamiltonian version. There is also, so this maybe about complex solutions. So there is also a related. So this is Glassy. And then also, Q and Tao, they showed that below this 3, so if you go Klein-Gordon below, so you go U to the 2P, U, P less than 1, there is a blow up in finite time. So even for small data. So this stuff is, this is really critical, right? P equal to 3. So, but this is slightly different equation, right? So here, on the other hand, if P is bigger than 1, you have scattering. So things are not, p equal to 3 seems to be the critical one for scattering for Klein-Gordon. And so here we have a corresponding question. So going by this, P equal to 2 should be false, right? So for the Ostrovsky, so I don't know. So here's an open question. Right, even that. Yeah, that's right. Right, p equal to 2 is completely open, I guess, right? Global solutions, even if they're not decaying, we still don't know whether they're global solutions or not. Yeah, that's right. So here's sort of a list with open question. Here I kind of stated obvious that the lower the p, the more difficult the problem is because there's just not enough decay in the nonlinearity. Okay, so here's what to do for p equal to 2, right? I just wanted to share with you, I couldn't resist the urge to, oops. Okay, so here's what you do in 2D. Here's how you transform the quadratic one to cubic one. That's all I'm going to say. So this goes by the name of normal forms. This is a little bit of advertisement. My student is going to talk about this stuff tomorrow, although in a different form. But here is the idea. So since we have issues with low power nonlinearity, here's what we do. Right, we start with U, which is a solution to the short poles, and would like to find, you know, a change of variables U going to V through this Trenier map. Okay, this is Trenier operate, you know. Right, so this is for the short pass, right? So this is trilinear, so that the equation for V becomes 5-linear. And so remember, you know, if I'm 5-linear, I'm probably in good shape, right? Because P equal to 5 works. Okay, and so V and U ideally should be sort of the same, right? Because, you know, through this transformation, if I have appropriate estimates for T. So let me see how I do. This sounds like, you know, science fiction at this point. Let me just tell you what I need. Okay, so here is what I need. I need two spaces, X and Y, so that they're good in the sense that linear Ostrovsky acts between them, right? So W in X is bounded by F in Y. Here I'm completely ignoring derivatives, right? Here I'm saying, okay, derivatives are, you know, I just want to see whether it works or not. So this is one thing that I need. So here is another thing that I need, right? So X is my solution space, and so I would like this T to preserve solution space, right? So if I start with U, 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 which is in the X, I would like to finish in the same space, right? So this is estimate number two. Okay, and estimate number three says that this is a good nonlinearity here, the M map, right? The five-linear map is a good map, which means the five-linear, this map in the space of nonlinearities, okay, is controlled back in terms of U, you know, all the entries in terms of solution space. So, okay, so far it's just a list of things that I cannot do, essentially. So, but let me go ahead and try this for P equal to 2. So if I wanted to do the same thing for the Ostrovsky-Hunter or whatever I should call it for P equal to 2, it is what I do, right? So let me just start with this. You can actually do this for P equal to 2. So here's what you do, right? You start with P equal to 2 case, and now you'd like to do a change of variables, which is quadratic, you know, it's like a bilinear in U, and you introduce a new variable V. Of course, you look for T in a form of essentially a multiplier, so pseudo differential operator in the two variables. So I call them U1 and U2. So I'm looking for sigma in this form, okay? So that with what is the property that I want? I want the linear Ostrovsky operator applied to this T to be equal to the nonlinearity plus cubic term, right? So cubic term is, for me, is error. Okay, so if I manage to do that, and I'll actually show you, you know, in explicit form, you can actually do that, then V, so the new variable V, will satisfy cubic Ostrovsky. So remember, I started with quadratic Ostrovsky, and then I end up with short pulse. Essentially short pulse, right? Cubic term, nonlinearity. Again, V and U are the same, so hopefully I shouldn't worry about that. Okay, so here's what you do, right? So what happens now? I apply this this linear Ostrovsky operator to this bilinear pseudo differential operator, and so this is the symbol, right? So this is the derivative in time, this is the derivative in space. There are i's that cancel, actually produce minus sign, and then I have another minus sign, so this is the symbol, up to minus sign. And so how do I write this symbol? I write it tau 1 c 1 plus 1, so this is again the symbol, but now only in the first variable. This is the symbol in the second variable, and then I have cross terms. Okay, so these symbols are good. So these symbols produce higher order terms. So these are my error, this is my M term. So let me worry about the last term. So how can I write this? Well, I create another symbol in the first variable, another symbol in the second variable, and finally this term. So every time I get symbols like this, 1, 2, 1, 2, these are all fine terms, okay? So the only term that I have at my disposition is this one. So Xi1 and Xi2 are the frequency of the two terms. And so remember, my goal was to organize things so that when I multiply this by sigma, I get a second derivative, which is right here, right? So this is the second derivative, and I have to put some constants, minus one, whatever. Okay, so now remember, now I would like to say something, right? So first of all, this is order two, right? So this is two derivatives, and, you know, this is homogeneous to degree two. So it's a Koifman-Meyer. Actually, if you look at the denominator, it's actually quite nice. It doesn't vanish. Or, you know, this is like a quadratic term that is strictly positive if you organize terms. And so it's actually a Korfman-Mayer symbol, which means very good. So it's like second derivative term, right? I mean, it's like a second derivative operator. So Korfman-Mayer means you can essentially ignore it. Okay, there's just a second derivative and the rest is manageable. Okay, so let me see now what happens with this, right? So here is the final, the output of this computation. So when you apply the Ostrovsky operator to T, what do you get? You get two terms like that, so I just put them together because U and U are the same. So you get two terms like that. You get what you want, okay? So this is zero term, this is zero term, this is the main term. And so now the rest, you get this kind of term. So where is this term coming from? This term is coming from this, okay? So what this means is Ostrovsky in the second variable, derivative in the first variable, antiderivative in the second variable, okay? And so if you organize things, you know, it looks exactly like this. Okay, and then you apply the fact that U solves the quadratic, the Ostrovsky Hunter, P equal to Q. So this actually is, of course, this. This here is a second derivative, but then I have inverse derivative, so it becomes... So all these become cubic terms, right? I mean, there are some derivatives involved, but okay. T actually is a second derivative operator. But so in essence, it's a cubic nonlinearity. And so I achieve this term modulo some cubic errors. Okay, so what is the final step is here. So if I start with U, which solves Ostrovsky 2, okay, when I apply this change of variables, I end up with this, and of course these two cancel, right? So the quadratic terms will cancel. And so what you get is that this solves cubic, right? So what I did with this sort of you know, relatively easy computation was I started with U, which solves Ostrovsky 2, and I finished with something which solves Ostrovsky 3, right? Although it's not quite short pulse, but sort of, right? It's a cubic term. So now you're going to ask me, or you should ask me, well, why don't you do the same for the cubic, bring it to quintic? And the answer is, so the answer is here, right? I can write this explicitly. The problem is that you see here, this is a nice symbol whose denominator doesn't vanish, right? And that makes it manageable. If you try to do this thing for SPE, for short pulse equation in three, so here, of course, you're going to have a trilinear, you know, symbol. And so when you do all this stuff, the denominator actually has singularities. Okay. And so now what you have to do is somehow do this transformation away from the singular set, okay, and don't do anything when you're very close to the singular set. So in that case, you split your equation into a cubic equation which is very highly localized close to the singular set of the multiplier, plus quintic equation which is fine, right? Which you know what to do about. And so likely you have this, I'm working on this, but the point is that you're going to have a small parameter, which, you know, how far you are from the singular set. So you're going to have a small parameter appearing in the cubic equation, which is going to keep you close to the singular set, and you're going to have a small parameter in the denominator for the quintic equation, and hopefully you can balance this out to work out, you know, in both cases. Remember, for the quintic, I can do actually down to the Strauss index, so I have some, you know, space there. So in any case, I mean, you can have some ideas. Like, I think this is the right approach to do the short pulse and even the P equal to 2 case, but nothing is definite yet. So I think I'm gonna stop here.